Closed captions are available for this video and full transcripts can be found on our blog.
Hi folks, I'm Kat Code, a data privacy consultant from Binary Tattoo and a member of the data collaboration community. Welcome to the Data Drop panel, where each month we gather some leading data and privacy professionals to hear about the news stories that stood out for them over the past month or so. In the fast-paced world of data privacy, it's always interesting to hear what's raising eyebrows and curling the fists of practitioners. I should note that all of the stories that we'll feature today have been included in our podcast, which delivers a 5-minute privacy news roundup every other week. This month on the Data Drop panel, we have three amazing guests. We have Jeff Jokisch, who's the CEO of Privacy Plan, David Kruger, who's the VP of Strategy at Apsio, and Heidi Sass, who's the Data Privacy and Technology Attorney. All right, actually, Heidi's going to kick us off today. So our first topic is the long-awaited U.S. data privacy bill that appears to be on track again. Heidi, why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, no longer a mythical creature. We have it in draft form. But as I've been telling people, believe you me, this is not the first draft. Like firstborn children were sold, like so many promises were made, like deals were cut all over the place. This is the deal that is supposed to represent all of the stakeholders. It's not just about privacy. This one also includes children, includes biometric data. It includes AI and audits. It includes so many different things, civil rights, just not consumer rights in cybersecurity. It's got a little bit of everything in here. I don't want to call it an omnibus because that's too all-encompassing here. But what it does have in it is some good stuff along with a couple of, you know, issues. And not everything that we want to be covered is going to be covered, but it's at least something right now, which is when we really, really need it in our country. Because I don't know if you're aware of what's going on in our country, but women are about to lose our right to bodily sovereignty. And so our data will be able to criminalize us, basically. So that's a story that we're going to cover next. But that is part of the driving force behind why now people suddenly pull a rabbit out of their hat and say, here is this giant privacy bill. So the major headwinds that it's facing in DC right now is Blumenthal and Cantwell. They don't support this. So it's a draft been introduced in the House. It's not been introduced in the Senate yet. And that's why, because they're not behind it. There are other competing bills that they feel like have stronger consumer protections. Part of their issue is the private right of action. So there is a private right of action, but it's very limited and it doesn't even kick in for 4 years. So 4 years is there so the other stakeholders can claw back any protections over time through whatever administration we may have next. So that's kind of the reasoning why it was drafted this way, the purpose and story behind the actual draft itself. So some of the great things that we do see in it are algorithmic bias in audits and things like that, because we're recognizing across the board, every industry is using these tools and nobody really knows how they work, but we do know they're causing disparate impacts. That's wildly illegal. So at this point, we need to do something just at least to raise the base level of knowledge and provide best practices for businesses so that they don't run afoul of these issues that they're not even aware of for the most part. So I think the new data privacy bill, it includes so many other moving parts that I can't really cover it in about 5 minutes. But those are some of the things that I see that are positive. Those are some of the things that I see that are going to hold it back. And we are limited by time. I think this is the most important part right now. We are limited by time. The August recess is upon us. And if we get to the August recess and nothing is done with this bill, it is likely that it will just lie fallow and do nothing because then we're caught up in the midterm elections. And then who knows what we have for the next, you know, setup for how Congress lines up. This is our best opportunity now. You can see where people are starting to add pressure. Elizabeth Warren just threw a new bill in last week just to throw fire on the flame to try to get Cantwell pushed back into this line so that she'll accept what everybody else is on board with. The hearing last week, I think, was interesting to me because I don't recall seeing a whole hearing of all the legislators, and all of the lobbyists who were there presenting their issues everybody on agreement about we've got to do something now. That was the vibe in the room, something, anything now. And everything else we can work out later. We all agree something's got to happen. I don't recall seeing that before. So I think that's the most unusual thing out of the whole circus that is this last, you know, 2 weeks of crazy privacy law. Right. So, and then Canada don't want to feel left out. So, I mean, they threw something in there too. And you got to get to that too.
They did. I don't know, Jeff, David, do you have anything to add to that one? I think Heidi's covered it.
Yeah. Well, I would say it's a pretty good bill. We got to pass it. There's some good coverage of data brokers in there. I like what it's doing with preemption. I mean, I'd rather it didn't preempt stuff, but we have to have some uniformity. And the fact that it's doing some limited preemption and still giving states the ability to do things like cover facial recognition laws and some other things, like leaving BIPA intact, I think that's good. So I'm pretty happy with this law. And I really like the fact that it's covering sensitive data really stringently, requiring opt-in for things like location tracking. That's important.
That's right. And I agree. Like location tracking should be sensitive data. I'm always surprised when it isn't.
There's the foam finger emoji on this.
Yeah. What's the timeline in the US for this? Like if this gets passed, what are we looking at before this is actually like a law where this is?
You know, I'm not sure what the dates are on it, but I think it goes into effect pretty quickly. It's only the private right of action that's delayed for like 4 years.
Yeah, there's a rolling basis for some of the other provisions that need to happen. But for the most part, day one, there's a flat out ban on using children's data, like flat out. And children, they've decided to identify as minors, not 13 to 16 and, you know, none of that, just as minors. So that'd be 18 and under.
That's great. All right, Jeff, we're going on to our next topic, which is yours. And that's the FTC Chair Khan plans key work, as we were just talking about kids, on kids' data privacy online.
Yeah. So Lina Khan at the FTC is saying that they're really going to crack down on children's data. You'll note that children's data is really sort of a subset or maybe even a superset of sensitive data, which is a real bugaboo of mine. And really what the FTC said is that they're going to crack down on education technology companies in particular, right, who illegally surveil children when they go online to learn. That's one of their real big focuses. And, you know, this is really a little bit of a response. You remember recently that senators were grilling executives from YouTube and TikTok and Snapchat about what they're doing to ensure user safety in the wake of suicides and other harms to teens attributed by their parents, the usage of those kinds of platforms after Facebook sort of got called onto the mat by Frances Haugen. So, you know, this is very much in the spotlight right now. But it's also because children's data is sensitive data, and it needs to be protected even more than our personal data, which needs to be more protected, right? So we have to have, you know, our privacy protected, our personal data protected, but children's data and sensitive data have to be even more protected. It requires not just an ability for us to opt out of that collection, but needs to be required to opt in to protect that sensitive data, that children's data. And while we've had laws like COPPA in effect for a long time, there are loopholes in that legislation that essentially let companies collect that data if they don't know that you're a child. And that's a really huge loophole that trucks drive through every day.
Yeah, and then for anyone listening who isn't familiar with COPPA, it's the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. And it does say that you can't pull data from children under 13, but then, which is why all of the social media, of course, has a minimum age of 13. And I used to do a lot of kids' internet safety workshops and like get into anyone under grade 6 and say, who here has an Instagram or a Snapchat account? And like every hand would go up, which means every one of those kids is lying about their age, which is perfectly on point, Jeff. Exactly what you said is that kids are lying in order to get in. So the data is being collected anyway.
Right.
David, why don't you tell us about Morena One and protecting users' privacy from Google and surveillance?
Well, there's a sort of a mantra of mine, partial privacy is no privacy, right? And this really has to do with the structure of data brokerages and how things flow. If a broker gets data from one source or 100 sources, they don't care. They care that they get the data. And then that data is sold and reused and reused and reused without end. So the thing that, and then there's another thing that's a particular peeve, being a curmudgeonly guy of mine, where things are marketed as being privacy enhancing without actually quantifying or qualifying what that means, right? So there was and I'm not dissing this product, and I'm glad that they're trying to do things like this, but you know, there's this couple of lines that I clipped out of there. We have removed many pieces of code that send your personal data to remote servers without your consent. Sounds great. What was the key word in that sentence? Right? Let me say it again. We have removed many pieces of code that send your personal data to remote servers without your consent. How do you?
Many.
Just that's many. Correct.
That's, yeah, there are many more.
That's
many
correct.
More. There are
many, many more. And again, the way the structure of the market works, if you're going to sell and reuse that information perpetually, right? There's no practical distinction between many and all, right? I mean, or many and some and all that. It is essentially, if you can't do all, you're not doing really anything except doing a little, you know, what I call rubbing a little privacy salve on you, you know, and then making money from it, right? It's not actually a solution to the problem. Not dissing these people. I'm glad somebody's doing something. But it is an illusion to think that they're actually doing anything that has real force and effect in the world. They also go on to say in this article, and because EOS, their proprietary operating system, runs on Android, you can still run most of your favorite Android apps, the company continues. So, Jeff, I think you snagged the Tim Horton story before I did. So these two things, and actually even the DuckDuckGo Microsoft story, they're all related to each other. Because again, if you don't stop the flow, period, you don't stop the flow at all. So if you can run your favorite Android apps, you know, ask yourself a question: why are there millions? Somewhere between 4 and 6 million now, I think, apps in the Android store. Why are there millions of apps? Do we have millions of actual applications that we need all those apps for? And the answer is no. Most apps in the App Store, their financial model is selling the data that they collect. So they have every impetus in the world to lie. And if you've got an OS that cuts off some functions that doesn't allow stuff to be sent out, and you allow them to load native Android apps, you know, into the thing, whose sole function for many of these apps is to collect the data and sell it to data brokerages and or to deliver advertising. And I love the ones that make you pay to not get ads, but still collect your information and sell it. God, you got to love the chutzpah for doing that. So again, these things are partial privacy is no privacy, but that does not prevent people from making buku bucks off of the earnest desire that we have for privacy. And frankly, that bothers me a lot.
Well, there's very little to add to what David said. I mean, he's just spot on. It's great to want to improve privacy, but I'm not sure how much this would really do to improve that privacy.
Yeah, it's a step in the right direction. The legislation is a step in the right direction. But the thing is that these are all battles that have to be fought and won. But we're still nowhere near winning the war.
I'll just add that I hate data brokers. I hate data brokers. Like, whatever you want to do, I mean, that's a good idea. So, I mean,
you know, I was actually just thinking one thing maybe we could add to this. If you actually, you know, implement a DSAR request and go to a couple data brokers and pull your data off of those data brokers, what is the real point of doing that? I mean, if you're individually going to try to do that and get your data out of like 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 data brokers, does that accomplish anything?
Sad. This is already out of the tube.
Yeah, remember this, privacy sad. Just rub a little bit on and you'll be fine. You know, it's we have cybersecurity sab on this arm too. So there are two things that are related, right? So
right.
All right, Heidi, you have our next topic, which you had touched on a little bit earlier. Health data privacy concerns grow as abortion laws change nationwide. What does this have to do with privacy and tracking?
So this is why everybody freaked out when Ruth died. Like this is why, because Roe being overturned, there are 13 different states that enacted legislation that says if Roe is ever overturned, it triggers new laws in those states immediately. And some of them criminalize the act, including accomplices. So if you're in Texas and your friend wants to use your phone to look up how do I get an abortion and travel to Maryland, that could be data collected and sold by a data broker or gathered by the government because they have all of these powers over big tech to walk in and say, give me data on people in this area or people searching these terms. And then they can pursue these people. So your period can lead to a sentence. And that's why we freaked out. That's a fundamental freedom that we have. It's a safety issue now. These lists, Safegraph was busted by Vice magazine for selling location data on people who were using Planned Parenthood services. And they offer a lot of services, but they were selling these lists. I want to know who's buying these lists and what are they doing with them? But also, you know, that turns it more from privacy into personal safety. So cyber can take a backseat for a minute because that's not, ransomware is like the last of my concerns right now. I'm more concerned with religious white people showing up when I'm trying to go to work if I'm a healthcare provider and they're shooting at me or something. Like these are real concerns because these are things that happen. So the fact that Roe being overturned, it's gonna upset the penumbras and emanations that privacy in our country is based on. So I don't even know how the decision is going to be written. But I read one of the leaked drafts from Alito, and I got to tell you, not since Plessy v. Ferguson have I read a Supreme Court decision that was so vile, so hateful, so paternalistic, and willingly ignorant of the issues. And I am afraid of a decision that comes out looking anything like that. So this is a big reason for everybody to get upset. Privacy is now everybody's problem. If you have a uterus or if you love someone with a uterus, now is the time to get involved in privacy because your information can be used against you in ways that you never thought possible and you never agreed to and you can't do anything about. So if you are using one of these apps, check out the FTC site, Federal Trade Commission, and their settlement with Flow. You can get some good information on the flow of your data through Flow right out to everybody they wanted to market all of your information to. So, and that was a big settlement that nobody really wanted to pay a lot of attention to because it involves the female cycle. And now it's at a point where you can't look away from this issue. I don't care how much you don't like to hear these words. You are going to have to get used to hearing these words because your rights are at stake too. So that's where I'm at on, you know, the health data. The HIPAA does not protect most of the information that you put into these apps, unless they are from a health service provider or your insurance company. And they do so many contracting and sub apps and this and that API to link things together that nobody's responsible in the end because we don't have strong enough laws for consumers to know about what's going on and enforce their rights. And until we get privacy rights in this country, we still won't be able to do much about this. So this is why everybody's freaking out now. This is why we freaked out when Ruth died. And this is why I'm going to keep freaking out until we get this decision, which could come as early as Wednesday.
Those data flows are all over the place. And every, you know, not just location data, search terminology, you know, variety of different things, right? If you search for abortion services or, you know, prenatal services or whatever, right? That information goes to ad tech vendors, goes to data brokers, can go to law enforcement, can go to, you know, anti-abortion, providers, what do you call those services, right? Pro-life services, and probably people that might be, you know, angry with you for thinking whatever you're thinking. So, yeah, it's a big privacy concern for people, whatever your thoughts are on the issue.
Well, you know, the thing is, again, you have the search engine, I mean, there's a story about DuckDuckGo giving stuff to Microsoft that, you know, violates their own policies. There's a technical problem with browsers. The way browsers are architected, you cannot stop, people from downloading stuff into a browser. You have the progressive web apps that don't go through any kind of vetting in an app store, which is, you know, the vetting in an app store. Again, you vet what you don't like. You don't vet things that don't give you information that you can resell and make money. So there's a lot of variability in those things. And the useful thing about all of this is the more, and I know this sounds terrible, but the more outrages that people have that are based on their privacy in one respect, that's almost got to happen for people to wake up and smell the coffee and realize that their personal information, A, has real value, and B, can be used against them by anybody for any reason. You know, so wake up. This privacy stuff isn't some side issue.
Right.
This is real serious stuff.
Yeah. Remember the real-time bidding stuff that Johnny Ryan's lawsuit is going after right now applies to this too. So if you're searching for services like this, your information is going out to potentially hundreds of different organizations every time you search for a term, and that includes abortion services.
Yeah. Massive ongoing data breach.
Yeah. Yep. And just to tie this one out to reiterate, because I think you all covered different areas, there is the curated version of I'm going to search something online. You're literally putting the term in. There's the maybe back of your mind version of these health apps that are tracking your cycle. And then there is this total non-curated area of geolocation where we're tracking people to these sites and people aren't like, we're not even thinking what apps are doing that. So now, David, you said wake up and smell the coffee. So we're now going to go back to Jeff for an issue about Tim Hortons. Everyone knows. Yeah. So Tim Hortons app collected vast amounts of sensitive data. So what is the story behind that one?
Yeah, so this is an interesting story. Apparently, Tim Hortons was unhappy that people were drinking coffee other than Tim Hortons coffee. And so they started tracking their customers when their customers were going to Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts. And some people found out about it. And one guy, a reporter, James McLeod, found out that Tim Hortons tracked him 2,700 times in less than a couple of months, 5 months. And so he did a story about this. And now Tim Hortons got in a lot of trouble. And obviously what they were trying to do is they were trying to protect their brand and, you know, find out when, you know, customers were going someplace else so they could probably try to figure out what they were doing wrong, which makes a hell of a lot of sense from a marketing perspective, not so much from a privacy perspective and a customer trust perspective. And so Canada Privacy Commissioner was not real happy with Tim Hortons, and that came down on them pretty hard. But as we discussed a little bit pre-show, I do not think there were any fines on Tim Hortons. They did agree to stop doing this, and they got in a hell of a lot of trouble, PR trouble, but there were no privacy fines because this is not illegal in Canada, at least at the moment. And so it's an interesting issue. It's not actually illegal, I don't think, in the United States right now, but it will be in 2023 because California, Colorado, and Connecticut are all making location tracking an opt-in because it's sensitive personal information. So that's the story. I imagine other people here might have a comment on that.
Yeah, well, again, from a development specter, from one aspect of this thing is that, you know, shame on Tim Hortons developers or their contract developers for being stupid enough to get caught. And I mean, I'm saying that tongue in cheek, but this goes to the underlying problem, right? Doing location tracking just doesn't happen in the app. It happens in the browser as well as it happens in the app, and it can happen while you're searching. And again, this goes back to some fundamental design problems that none of this legislation ever exists. It's all reactive, right? It's oh, you did a bad thing and you shouldn't do that. And we're going to make a law against you doing that. But the legislators never ask the question. They always ask the question, how are we going to stop this? They never ask the question, why is it possible? They never attack the fundamental technical engineering things that make all this crap possible. And again, I think I'm glad we're seeing progress. I'm not discounting that stuff. But until they get to the fundamental questions, why is this possible? Then we get to real privacy. We'll never get there as long as they keep on focusing on how do we stop it. That's the wrong question. It's too far downstream to solve the problem.
That's our privacy and protection by design. Yep.
Yeah, why weren't there any fines, Kat? What's going on with that? Why weren't there any fines?
A couple things. First of all, Tim Hortons we have consent and transparency things in Canada like that. We do have not geolocation, although it's coming. But the Tim Hortons, at my understanding, because you don't drink coffee, is that its intent was that you would open it and say, you know, where's the closest Tim Hortons, which is always like 30 meters away. And then you would say, this is my order, which Tim Hortons do you want it ready at? And you would press the button. So there was a legitimate reason to have geolocation baked into the app. But it should have been, like you're saying, David, privacy by design. It should have, the whole idea and the consent and transparency was that we will use location in order to identify the closest Tim Hortons to where you are. And then the location was left on 24/7. And I'm thinking even you could track someone from home to work and say, this person always stops at Tim's 10 minutes after they've left their home, no matter when they leave their home, whether it's at 8 a.m. or 3:00, they always stop at Tim's 10 minutes after they've left their home. I mean, even that data is not what they were supposed to be collecting. We do have another story, and then we can talk about a little bit about the Canadian law, but the geolocation is being marked as sensitive data. In the new Canadian law. So, yay.
What I wish somebody would have asked in this article is not just the fact that they did collect it. What I want to know is, which was not in the article, is did they sell it? Going back
data
to
brokers.
Data broker question.
Where the whole, everything could just sum up with data brokers.
I hate
all right, David, numbers. Yeah, you've got our last story. So you had kind of alluded to this one before. DuckDuckGo is caught giving Microsoft permission for trackers despite its strong privacy reputation.
Who is that? Is that for me?
That's for you.
No, okay. All right. No. Well, again, it's all of a piece. And this is the problem. You've got whoever's doing search, whoever's selling a browser, right? And whoever's installing an app. Right, whether that's a browser-based app or whether it's something get installed natively on the device, and if you've got leakage from any of the three of them, again, there's no privacy unless there's no partial privacy. It's either private or it's not. So again, in this one news cycle, we've got the Tim Horton app, we've got the DuckDuckGo ostensibly private browser, and then you always have data collection by anybody who's running a search. Not everybody. There are some search engines that do not collect information, but they're rare and they're not well used, right? So those are three holes that you have to fill. And again, fundamentally, the thing that we don't address is what makes that possible, because you can slap people's hand and you can fine them, and as long as the amount of fines is something that they can write off as a cost of doing business, which is true across the board. Slapping their hands is never going to stop. Is never going to solve the problem. Again, privacy by design at the browser level, at the app level, and at the search appliance level, and at the social media level, all the things that have yet to be addressed in any single piece of legislation that I've seen.
Yeah. I want new devices. I want our devices to be built differently because we're going to use services differently moving forward. So I want my devices to be built differently, but that doesn't really make good business sense for them right now. So that's kind of where I'm hung up, because here's the situation. I'm at the office, I'm hanging out, I'm on my computer and my phone are talking. I didn't tell them to, they do. I leave, I get in the car, my phone and my car are talking. I don't want them to, but they do. Then I get home, I got my other computer. You know, by the time I get back to the office on Monday, my phone is like, guess how all these tech items she's been using, telling all my secrets to everybody. And, you know, I didn't give consent to any of that stuff. You know, I mean, it's almost like a jealous mate. Like, were you using another computer? Did they have better graphics than I do? Like, what is all this about? Like, if this was a person in your life that acted this way, you would ditch them because they're nutso. So I'm not really sure, you know, how we can convince the device makers to make better devices that are privacy respecting and privacy by design in the device. But if we're going to live our life out of this and it's going to be our passkey to everything else, we're going to need better devices. They can't, like, we can't go in the metaverse with this crap. This is not okay. So, I mean, we can't do data ownership with these either. Access, not copies, right? That's what we're looking to do. So we want to own the data. We want to give people access to it. We don't want people making copies of it, but we've got to build that technology into the infrastructure, starting with our devices. So that's where I'm at with that. So I'm glad to see people are starting to do a little bit here and there, but it's like you said, it is privacy washing. So the more we call that out, you know, the more people are going to realize there's so much more we should pay attention to.
You know, I think the ultimate solution is, as we move to this next version of the web, whether that's the Web 3 or the metaverse or whatever it is, I think we have to control our identity. And there are a lot of solutions that people have been working on for a long time now. There's so many people working on identity from so many different angles. Who knows really what's gonna happen? But ultimately, we need to control that identity, and hopefully, it's some sort of a self-sovereign, you know, parsable identity solution. If we can actually get there, if we can control that identity, it solves a lot of our privacy issues, because then we can actually parse out that identity in ways that allows us to control our data more effectively. But of course, if identity goes in the wrong directions, it could actually be much more of a disaster for privacy than we have right now. So it's a problem.
Well, you know, I'll throw this in here, beware Web 3.0, because, you know, we're trying to control our identities. We're trying to control our data. Web 3.0 so far is a very difficult thing to define. And, you know, if you think of your data as something that's mobile, something that moves around, because it is physical, it is real objects that are controlled by physics that get moved around and used by machines and people. So far, Web 3.0 is an attempt to put the brakes and the steering wheel on the highway instead of the car. That's probably not going to work out very well. The amount of hype around Web 3.0 and the amount of engineering substance is extraordinary. And I love that term, privacy washing.
You should also check out my article that I published today on the Interline Magazine, Fashion Tech, Fashion and Gaming.
I read your stuff.
At the Interline about privacy and trust as brand messaging in the metaverse, because there's so much garbage out there.
I will read your stuff. And again, because I like your stuff. But there's a lot of hype. Just, you know, keep that little thing in your mind. When people are talking about changing the structure of the internet to accommodate privacy, remember the brakes and the steering wheel, which is the controls we want on our data, right? The brakes and the steering wheel go on the car, not the road.
And we already built the car and we didn't put the brakes on it. Now people are
correct, and then you can read all of my articles that point that out there. So
there we go.
And we love your articles too.
Abundance of analogies that I love. All right, so quickly, the Canadian law that has just been announced on June 16th, which is new. As Jeff had said earlier, we didn't used to have a tribunal that could actually create fines or say that anything was illegal, and that's coming in Canada. So our fines actually are up to 4%, like GDPR, or 3%, I think, but there's a 5%. There's a 5% of gross revenue that's coming in, especially from an AI perspective, which is all new in Canada. So we are getting an AI and Data Act and an actual AI data commissioner to deal with ethics. And I know Heidi does a lot of work on data ethics around AI. So we are looking at algorithms and how it's using data and abusing data. The big thing in our, we had a CPPA because we don't have enough acronyms, as everyone says. And that was the Consumer Privacy Protection Act, was announced last year. That version is also coming in, includes, we didn't used to have the right to deletion. Now we will have that right to portability, all that great stuff. But one of the big things everyone complained about last year was that de-identified information was not considered personal information because it had been de-identified. And in the world of data brokers, and Heidi's already shaking her head, we know that they don't know how to properly de-identify information to a point where it cannot be re-identified. So now the argument is that de-identified information in this new law is personal information, falls under all of these wonderful rules and regulations. Oh. And that if it is truly anonymized, then it can be used and abused because it is not personal information. So I am waiting because we need subsequent things to go with this, with what that definition of anonymized means. Because again, we see this often where people like, I'm only using gender and postal code and this one other thing. And then you have one non-binary individual in this one area, and then bam, you have identified the individual. So so we are waiting on how we're actually going to define that. But pardon?
Is it passed?
Yes, it's coming. It's coming. I'm the non-lawyer, so I don't know how this whole thing works, but yes, it's coming for sure. Does that mean it's passed?
Like, is it a law?
The non-lawyers,
is it a bill? Is it passed? Is it happening for sure? I mean,
it's happening for sure. It is happening for sure. So yes.
Awesome.
Yes. I don't know what the terminology for that, but it is happening for sure.
It's law and it's coming soon.
And we might actually be using, we have postal code, which is like zip code. We might actually be using that as an identifier. We'll see. Like, that might actually be construed as enough of a personal piece of information that all of the data brokers in Canada might be in trouble because so many of them use that. Because our postal codes are by even side of the street and odd side of the street. They're very specific. So sometimes the areas are very small. Sometimes they're bigger. Either way, so that's the Canadian law. So now everyone knows. I don't know if anyone had any closing remarks. I think we covered a lot today.
Yeah, it's important. You know, I would throw one stat out here real quick. I don't know if people realize how easy it is to re-identify data, but if you know the gender of somebody and you know their zip code, it's something like 50% likely that you can actually figure out within, I think it's like 50% of the time, you can uniquely identify that individual. It's like relatively trivial. So
yeah. And the location data too, you know, I mean, numerous stories have been done on this, but I'll just tell you where I live right now. There's six people in a square mile right now. The square mile I'm in, there's only six people in it. Right. Well, so, I mean, yeah. And how many of those are data privacy badass lawyers? One. right. So, I mean, that's kind of a problem. And I'm worthy of vigilante justice too. So I really need somebody to do some work on privacy rights for me in this country, because I really want to get back working on access to justice. But I can't do anything on that big societal issue until we have rights in our data and trustworthy data practices. So if we could get this resolved and move over to data ownership, do access, not copies, and get that handled already, then I can move on to what I really want to do. And then I'll be less cranky. I promise.
Yeah. What I'm waiting for, this logical progression where you do get the data brokers who do have some laws that say that they have to so forth, you know, de-anonymize, you know, I mean, the data. And they take it as an opportunity to open up a sister company that does open source intelligence capabilities to reattach the data to identities, so they get the bill twice.
So Science and Technology is asking for comments. They're due by July 8th. If you have some comments on privacy enhancing technologies, if you know of a PET, if you're working on a PET, or if you just want to tell the OSINT community in Science and Technology as you're setting forward best practices, please send your comments in so that you can let them know PETs are not commonly are not common across the board. They're also not effective. A lot of them are snake oil. We need to develop audit capabilities for these things. We need to verify that the PETs are working before we mandate their use. So if you want to speak on that issue, I would highly encourage you or anybody else to reach out and let me know. I'll give you all the information you need so you can send those comments to the people who can do something about it.
Nice.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. So that's a wrap. We're going to thank our guests again, Heidi Sass, Jeff Jokisch, and David Kruger. I'd also like to invite everyone to listen into the free, our free podcasts that happen again every few weeks, and join the free data collaboration community. We're a vibrant group, look at us, vibrant, of data savvy professionals who collaborate on open data sets and build free tools for important causes. You can visit datacollaboration.org/community to learn more about becoming a founding member and get the link to sign up. So thank you again, everyone, and until next time.
Thank you.
Bye.
The Data Drop is a production of the Data Collaboration Alliance, a a nonprofit dedicated to advancing meaningful data ownership and global collaborative intelligence. Data Job viewers are invited to check out our free community where members collaborate on datasets, dashboards, and open tools in support of important causes. Visit datacollaboration.org.